This is a republic if you can keep it, with former Democratic Party Chairman Mark Brewer, and former Republican Party Executive Director Jeff Timmer. The presenting sponsor of this week's podcast is Epic MRA Public Opinion Research.
Epic MRA is a Lansing-based market research and public opinion polling firm with nearly four decades of experience accurately measuring public opinion about politics, ballot proposals, and other federal, state, and local issues. Epic MRA is one of the most quoted polling firms in the country. Clients include media outlets, school districts, colleges and universities, state agencies, local governments, labor unions, interest groups, and businesses throughout Michigan. Whether it's measuring voter opinion about who's up or down in elections, or if ballot proposals or legislation can earn voter approval, Epic MRA is known as the go-to Michigan pollster. Visit www.epicmra.com to learn more.
I'm Mark Brewer. Welcome to our weekly podcast. Jeff Timmer is not with us this week as he and his family grieve the death of their youngest son. Our heart goes out to Jeff and his family, and we hope he will be back with us as soon as possible. Pinch hitting for Jeff this week is one of the best of the state capitol journalists, Craig Wagner of the Detroit News. Prior to joining the news, Craig was executive director of the nonpartisan Michigan Campaign Finance Network, where he tracked the money that drives the political system. Craig is a graduate of Howell University's Scripps School of Journalism. He has spent years working as a journalist covering government and politics. Before he worked at the Campaign Finance Network, he was a reporter for Mears in Lansing. And of course, since leaving the Campaign Finance work, he's been working at the Detroit News. He has written extensively about the changing role of politically focused nonprofits, investigated the purchase of the new Senate office building several years ago, and uncovered that a top state official was benefiting from a primary residence tax breaks in two states, among many, many other stories that he has covered. At the Detroit News, Craig has continued to specialize in following the money. Craig, thanks so much for being with us this week.
Hey, thank you so much, Mark, for having me. I just wanted to say off the top that Jeff Timmer's family has been in my thoughts and prayers throughout this week. And, it's I feel a privilege to come on here and be able to kind of pinch hit for him today.
I really appreciate that. Thank you very much. So there's so much going on that we can talk about that is right in your wheelhouse. Why don't we pick up with the latest that's going on with the Chatfield investigation? We saw recently raids on the home of his top staffers, fights over subpoenas apparently issued to others looking for records for the ongoing state police investigation. What have you uncovered recently about what's going on with Chatfield?
Yeah, so on Wednesday, we had a story run in our newspaper that we had been spending, we had spent multiple weeks digging into, tracking all of the travel, as much of the travel, I should say, as we can, that Lee Chatfield was doing as a state lawmaker. And what we basically found is that all indications are that he was benefiting from this loophole that has emerged in Lansing, where lawmakers form nonprofit organizations. The nonprofit organizations can raise hundreds of thousands of dollars from anonymous donors. And then those nonprofits can fund travel for these lawmakers, essentially providing a back door around normal lobbying disclosures. And, you know, the fascinating thing here is that these lobbying disclosures were put into law in the 1970s to try to shine light on financial influence on government. That was the reason. And now we've essentially reached a point in Michigan where that disclosure does nothing. And we're to a pre-Watergate era of not having transparency for this type of travel, which is a stunning fact.
Right. I mean, this is something that one of our recent guests, Bob LeBrat, predicted would happen back in the 90s when they got rid of office holder expense funds, which required disclosure of this. And you're right. The lobbying laws were intended to disclose if a lobbyist pays for a legislator's travel, has to be disclosed. Now, the lobbyist or their client simply gives tens of thousands of dollars to the C4 and accomplishes the same purpose, right? Mm-hmm. With a lot less disclosure, because under the IRS rules, there's no disclosure of where the C4's money came from. You see lump sums reported on their annual tax returns, but you have no idea who that is, who's been buying favor, who's been making those contributions to these C4s, and they turn into these giant slush funds that you've been investigating. What have you been able to uncover, though, in your detective work in terms of where he went and how they got paid for?
Yeah, I mean, we've uncovered multiple trips that have never been reported before. Over his final 4 years in the House, he was the Speaker pro tem and the Speaker, 2 years of Speaker pro tem, 2 years of Speaker. We know that he went to Israel twice, which a lot of lawmakers go on this Israel junket that's sponsored by the Jewish Federation of Metropolitan Detroit. We know that he went to Puerto Rico twice on two different trips. We know that he went to Hawaii. In 1 2-month period alone, we tracked trips to New Orleans, Florida, and Puerto Rico, and all of them were tied to public policy. So when you ask, does this affect public policy? The people that are involved with these trips are involved with them to impact public policy. You know, there were gaming interests. There were the Beer and Wine Wholesalers Association were events that he went to. We know that he went on two different trips tied to the National Popular Vote Organization that had been courting Republicans to try to support that movement. And it's kind of interesting. It's one thing to go to one seminar in Hawaii, but why would you go to a seminar in Puerto Rico and Hawaii for the same subject? And why would you go to Israel for the same event twice? We don't know how we funded all of these, but in one of the instances, there were five lawmakers that went to Puerto Rico for a beer and wine event. Four of them showed up in lobbying disclosures. One of them didn't. And that one was Lee Chatfield. All indications are from the people involved is that he paid his own way to get there. And he told at least one source that we talked to that when he paid his own way, he used his nonprofit to pay his way. So, you know, technically, maybe that is paying your own way, but it's really other people's money that ended up funding it, according to the source.
Right, right. And, you know, you've got this very extensive, network of moneyed interests. And, of course, the Speaker is the key figure in the House. Nothing moves in the House without the Speaker saying so. So of all the people you want to lobby and keep happy, it's the Speaker. And of course, we all know these junkets leave plenty of free time, right, yeah, for the extracurriculars, shall we say, that have been reported to be engaged in by Chatfield, the expensive dinners and who knows where else.
Yeah,
they spent time while they were on these expensive junkets paid for by his C4. And I think this is just the tip of the iceberg. These C4s have become very popular on both sides of the aisle in Lansing. And as you indicated earlier, you know, just the latest way to evade the disclosure requirements of our very antiquated and weak lobbying laws and our campaign finance laws. I mean, look, under the campaign finance laws, as you know, Craig, there are provisions in there that an office holder can pay for a wide variety of things related to holding office. But you got to disclose.
Yes.
What you spent and where you spent it. And this is another way to evade that through these dark money C4s. Do you think there's any interest or energy at all in terms of reforming this? I mean, I read outrage statements from both sides of the aisle.
Yeah.
Is that going to mean anything in the end? What do you think, Craig?
I think it depends on a couple of things. I think there's more movement to do something about this now than there has been in any other time in my time covering Lansing, which is, you know, a decade now. There are lawmakers on both sides of the aisle that say something has to be done on this. There's talk about maybe going back to the old expense accounts that we used to have in Michigan. You know, the questions are, how far is this Chatfield investigation going to go? You know, if authorities are digging into the use of this fund and if there are eventually charges brought, we don't know where this is going to end up. We don't know even if laws were violated at this point yet. Depending how far this goes could influence the pressure on lawmakers to do something. But, you know, I will say Lansing right now is quietly grappling with some major subjects. These lawmakers are wrestling with the role of the lobbyists. I mean, we have a very powerful lobbying culture in this state that's driven by multi-client firms that are extremely influential. A lot of other states don't have that. And I think lawmakers are starting to wonder, has this gone too far? And another major subject, I mean, I can't underscore this enough, that is quietly simmering here, is the power of these leadership figures. The speaker, the majority leader, they wield so much power over what happens in Lansing every day. Donors give to them, and then they decide how to hand that money out to the regular members. And I think a lot of regular members are sitting there right now looking at what Lee Chatfield did, looking at the amount of money he raised, looking at the amount of travel that he benefited from, and saying, this system is set up and it's benefiting, you know, a handful of people. And at the end of the day, it makes all of us look bad. And at the end of the day, the people who are in the position to change the system are the ones who benefit it from it most. So it's going to be very interesting to watch if these, you know, normal members of the caucus, just a regular member who doesn't chair a committee, if they're going to come together and tell the leaders, you have to do something about this. Now, there is talk. Senator Ed McBroom is looking at whether we should start limiting leaders to one leadership pack. Lee Chatfield had four packs. And if the leadership packs were limited to one per lawmaker, that alone would cut into the power of the speaker and the majority leader that they wield right now.
Right. I mean, there's so many ways to multiply that power. You know, we've talked on this program before about the enormous budgets in both the Senate and House, which are under the sole control of the Speaker in the House and the Majority Leader in the Senate, with no accountability publicly or to the members. I've been pushing for an investigation there. What did Chatfield spend out of that account in terms of whether it was bonuses for people? Maybe there was travel involved. There may have been abuses of that money. So you got that going on. And there are a lot of ways that this could be reformed. You know, these C4s are corporations, usually nonprofit corporations, and nonprofit corporations have to register and report with the state of Michigan. You could expand reporting there. You could expand reporting under the Campaign Finance Act. You could expand reporting under the Lobbying Act. You could indicate that, look, if a legislator is on the board or founded or has any role whatsoever in a C4, that's all got to be disclosed, including the money that they raised and spent for that C4. And that'll be a way, I think, to close some of these loopholes that are really, I think, eroding public trust in the whole process.
Yeah. And there is a huge appetite among a lot of the legislators right now to go further than what I'm about to mention. But, you know, a lot of states handle this in a very simple fashion. Every year you file a financial disclosure. And one of the elements of the financial disclosure is, what trips did you go on that were funded by outside sources? And where did you go? So, you know, that's not going to get at who funded all of these trips, because if it's a nonprofit organization, it's going to hide the actual donor. But at least there would be some accountability there that says, hey, Lee Chatfield went on 30 trips or whatever the number is, we don't know, and they were to this, and this exotic locale, and it was funded by his nonprofit, the Peninsula Fund. And then it would be on people like me, his voters, to go to him and ask, well, where did your Peninsula Fund get this money? And why was it necessary to go to Hawaii? Why was it necessary to go to Puerto Rico? And then voters, what this is all about is giving voters insight into what their representative is doing in Lansing. You know, these are people that are sent here to work on behalf of their constituents. And right now, as one lawmaker said in the piece, and I hope people go read it, he said, the fundamental problem, the fundamental evil right now is a lack of information. Essentially, this information is being hidden, and it's on these lawmakers to do something about it.
Right. No, I agree. There's lots of different ways to come at this. I want to turn to another topic, if we can, that I know you've been covering a lot, and that's the emergence of what I'll call the Big Lie Caucus in the legislature as well. I mean, we have seen people already in the two Republican caucuses, particularly in the House, you know, embrace the big lie. You know, we've seen Representative Maddox has been a longtime leader of that. And of course, his spouse is co-chair of the Republican Party and a leader and a big Trump supporter. But recently in these primaries, we have seen people winning Republican primaries, like this Robert Regan this week, who made the infamous remark about enjoying rape, who apparently believes the Ukraine invasion is a fake, among other things. Over in my neck of the woods is Terrence McCoskey, another big lie believer, Trump supporter. He won a primary against an establishment Republican figure. We may get Melissa Carone, you know, again, in her infamous appearance dating back to the hearing with Rudy Giuliani. I mean, there's this part of the Republican Party appears to be gaining strength in the legislature. What's your take on all these developments?
I mean, it's one of the underlying storylines of 2022's pivotal midterm election in Michigan. There are Republicans who are concerned about what's happening and are wondering that if this continues, if the party continues to nominate people in the primary that are the voters' view as extreme, that are focused as their number one issue on relitigating the 2020 election, that that could cost them pivotal seats in the state house. I mean, the state house after redistricting this fall is going to have an election unlike anything that it's had in decades because of the number of battleground seats. There are going to be dozens of battleground seats. Usually, you know, maybe there, as you know, maybe there's eight battleground seats. Maybe there's 10. We're going to have double that, potentially triple that, seats that are in play that either side can win. And if the GOP nominates through their primary elections in August, a number of these people who are, you know, very far to the right that are focused on the 2020 election, that this could jeopardize Republicans' ability to hang on to the majority in the House. I think both sides, people on both sides would acknowledge this, and it's something to watch. I mean, it is definitely something to watch.
Well, I think, though, there's also, you know, it gets even more complex. It's not just about the 2020 election. I mean, again, this Robert Regan made this crazy, terrible remark about rape this week. And it was so bad that even the misogynistic, racist chair of the Republican Party, Ron Weiser, spoke up. I mean, you remember Ron Weiser of the Three Riches remarks and everything else. Even he criticized Regan. It seemed to be real hypocrisy given Weiser's background. But the Republican establishment, you know, I think, was it the Freedom Fund this week? They went after Regan. But I think, you know, they need to figure out if they haven't already, they may have to start playing in some of these primaries. The caucuses can't by law, but some of these special interest groups, big funders in the Republican Party, can help stop this by getting involved in these primaries. And some of these elections are really close. Regan didn't win by that much. Nor did McCoskey. But you get these low turnout primaries in these gerrymandered districts, and this is what happens. You know, and I know the congressional Republicans have had fits over what the Freedom Caucus does there. Mm-hmm. That'll be child's play compared to the big lie caucus that seems to be emerging in the state house or in the state Senate. And you're right, it could have an impact on who controls the legislature. But even if the Republicans maintain control, if they've got 3, 4, 5, 6 or more of these real right-wing crazies, how do you govern? How do you pass things in the legislature? Because these folks show no hesitancy about going after the existing leadership, right? I mean, they owe loyalty to nobody except Trump. And that's their North Star. And that's where this whole thing seems to be headed.
Yeah, and I think, you know, you raised some good points there of what could be lying ahead for the House caucus and the Senate GOP caucus potentially. But, you know, in 2012, 2014, I was covering the state house on a regular basis for Mers News. And, you know, I remember very vividly the battles that unfolded between the Tea Party and the establishment. And those were very open battles. We saw this play out. It was an open war for control of the future of the Republican Party. It's been quieter now, but I think there's a battle gaining steam between the ardent Trump supporters. And I don't know if establishment is even the right word. I mean, some of these people that are now considered establishment were not considered establishment a few years earlier, but it's really the people who are dedicated and fully on board with Donald Trump's movement and other Republicans who are kind of, you know, supportive of Trump, but not going to go along with everything that he says. And that's the question kind of is this going to become a very public war? Are they going to start attacking each other? Or is it going to be more of what we've seen play out in this attorney general convention race so far, where Trump is going supporting Matthew DiPerno, attacking Tom Leonard now on a regular basis, the former state house speaker. And Leonard is really trying to stay focused on his message. He's not really going back at Trump and DiPerno. That this convention race is kind of going to be a test for how this works. And, you know, will Tom Leonard start attacking what DiPerno is doing and saying about some of the 2020 election stuff? Or is he going to try to just run this forward focused campaign on, hey, I'm going for the nomination? You know, which way is that going to go? What lessons are going to be learned there? I think Republicans are learning lessons from these special elections of how they're going to handle it. You know, they were kind of quiet in their opposition in some ways to Reagan. Then after the election, they're publicly not disavowing him, but publicly criticizing him. The next couple of months will be telling on that front.
Yeah, I mean, you know, I know that not you, but some of your colleagues have been saying, well, Trump's influence is weakening. I don't see any sign of that here in Michigan. I mean, just this week, we had the big lie convention down at Mar-a-Lago, you know, where we had Michon Maddock, DiPerno, Marion Sheridan, and I think others go down there to raise money with Trump. You know, embracing the guy, not hiding from him at all. We got the Republican endorsement convention coming up, where not only DiPerno wants the nomination, is in this fight with Leonard, as you indicated, but this Kristen Karamo, who is also a big lie believer, and I think would be a disaster as Secretary of State. You know, she wants to be the Secretary of State nominee. So I just see these Trump forces through these primaries, this fundraiser, the upcoming endorsement convention, gathering steam inside the Republican Party, not losing influence at all. Am I missing something?
I mean, I think from any indicator that we've had so far within the Republican Party, especially, you know, the delegates, the people that are most active within the GOP, Trump's influence is still strong. And we saw this in the special election. Terrence McCoskey wins. Robert Regan wins. These aren't Trump-backed candidates, but these are people that are kind of very Trump-like in how they're running their campaigns. They're victorious. This convention race cannot be understated and how much it will be a barometer for where the Michigan GOP is. Again, these are the most ardent Republican people. These are the delegates. So if Trump does win, and DiPerno wins, which is a Trump win now, he's all in on this race, that will be a sign that Trump is very influential and can even defeat someone like Leonard, who is very well liked in GOP circles and has been working in Republican Party politics intensely for a long time. That's still a different voter base than the primary elections that we'll see in August. And of course, the primary election voters on the GOP side are much different than the general electorate that we'll see in November. And the signs that we've seen so far is that Trump's approval rating with that general electorate is going down while it remains strong with the Republican voters.
Right. But even Leonard's still got issues, right? Going back to our Chatfield discussion because of his ties to Chatfield. I mean, he was like Chatfield's mentor, right? Chatfield was Speaker Pro Tem under Leonard. And DiPerno has not hesitated to tie Leonard to DiPerno. So, I mean, I think, tie Leonard to Chatfield. Yeah. So I think, you know, this is all going to play out in a very interesting way. I mean, even this week, we had an op-ed by Bob LeBrant, you know, the longtime power at the Michigan Chamber of Commerce, where he says we shouldn't be nominating people at these conventions, because conventions are controlled by these handful of activists. Now, that's a very different message than what we've heard out of the Republican Party for the last 50 years. But I think even establishment figures like Bob in the Republican Party are very worried about what's going on, who's controlling these conventions and the type of extreme candidates that are going to get nominated. And so when you see a Bob LeBrant raise that kind of issue, you know that inside the Republican Party, there's very serious discussion and worry about these trends. You know, but while all this is going on, more and more evidence comes out that the big lie is the big lie. This week we had the Michigan Auditor General issue a report. And people should know, the Auditor General is appointed by the legislature, in this case, the Republican-controlled legislature, and they tasked him with essentially double-checking a lot of the election audits that were done in the last couple of years. And he came back and said, basically, things were fine. He had a few suggestions for improvement, but nothing significant at all, nothing to cast doubt on the election results. I know there's going to be a big deal. Well, we had some folks who died before Election Day. Well, guess what? That always happens. Mm-hmm. People die after they vote. That's not a new phenomenon in Michigan. And it certainly wasn't enough to affect the election results. And I'm sure the people who died were both Democrats and Republicans. So this is not some conspiracy by one party. But again, we see continued evidence come out every time things are looked at. There's no problem. Well, what are your thoughts? Did you get a chance to look at the Auditor General's report and review it?
Yeah, I encourage people to go read it. It's pretty interesting. And I think I tweeted this out last week that, you know, this is the definitive debunking of this conspiracy theory that there were a large number of ballots cast on behalf of dead people. I mean, this theory was rampant after the election. And after you read this report, this is a nonpartisan, well-respected Auditor General's office. There is no way that this is possible. I mean, they went through the public health data comparing death certificates and public health information to who the voters were. So, I mean, there's just no way that this is possible. I mean, Donald Trump was publicly floating this idea that there were 18,000 ballots cast on behalf of dead people. He said that in a call with the Georgia Secretary of State, 18,000 ballots he heard cast on behalf of dead people in Michigan. It turns out that, you know, there were maybe 2,000 votes cast by dead people. And in almost all of these cases, almost all of them, except a couple dozen, the people had died just in the days before the election, meaning likely they sent in their absentee ballot and then died. And there's delays with getting death certificates. There can be delays in this showing up in the state's database. The vote was likely counted just because of those delays and that death not being not showing up in the data available to the clerks yet. So it's a fascinating report. I mean, they did identify some issues with local jurisdictions training and participation in audits that happened after the election. But again, these are after the election. There's nothing in this report, once again, that indicates that there was any type of significant fraud happening in this state's vote.
Yeah. So let's turn in our remaining time to some of the public policy issues that are dominating Lansing this day. Obviously, big debate about the budget. The state is holding on to a huge surplus thanks to enhanced revenue, but also money that has flowed from the federal government that hasn't spent. And we now see competing efforts by the governor and the legislature to, for example, cut the gas tax. Governor Whitmer says the feds should cut the federal gas tax. The legislature says, no, we should cut the Michigan gas tax and backfill it. And then the legislature also passed a huge tax cut bill, which experts say will have a long-term negative impact on the stability of the state budget. What's your take of all this budget back and forth? Is this election they're posturing? Can the governor and legislature make a deal on the budget and on these tax cut issues?
A lot of what they're doing, of course, is posturing from both sides. I mean, you have Governor Whitmer saying, hey, federal government, you need to, you know, suspend the federal gas tax. The Republicans say, hey, that's a political gimmick. Then you have Republicans turning around and saying, let's suspend the state gas tax. I mean, there's a recognition from Democrats and Republicans that something needs to be done to combat rising consumer prices. Something's got to be done. And it's how do they reach a consensus on that subject? Republicans are trying to go as big as they possibly can. I mean, a $2.5 billion tax cut is a historic and significant tax cut that they're advancing. Governor Whitmer has said, you know, that's fiscally irresponsible. That goes too far. We'll see in the next few days. You know, she's likely going to veto this. We'll see the veto likely come down in the next few days and what her rationale and argument is. There's going to be some type of tax relief. I feel confident saying that. It's just, what is it going to look like? And how do the two sides position themselves in the months before the election to argue? I mean, to argue about it. They're going to have to reach a consensus to do something. So at the end of the day, they're going to have to work together on this. And then how do you criticize each other when at the end of the day, you're working together to do something?
Right. I think hanging over all of this is that they're all the incumbent legislators, whether they're running for reelection in their current district or new districts, or they're running for a different body, are eager to get on the campaign trail, right? I mean, these districts have changed dramatically. You know, I still believe that the two plans remain biased toward Republicans, but they are dramatically different plans. The Republicans drew basically gerrymandered incumbent protection maps back in 2011. These are not incumbent protection maps. The commission was barred from considering incumbency. So there's a lot of open seats. There's a lot of new territory added to districts. There are a lot of districts that lost a lot of territory. And I know these legislators on both sides of the aisle are itching to get out there on the campaign trail. And they're not eager to spend June and July in Lansing fighting over these kinds of issues. I mean, they want to take credit, obviously, for a budget, a tax cut, whatever the case may be. But they also need to get out there and campaign in these brand new districts. So I think there's going to be pressure there from, and we talked about this before, pressure from the backbenchers and the rank and file members saying, look, make a deal, right? Make a deal with the governor so we can get some relief out here because we want to go campaign. Mm-hmm. We want to go get this, you know, get reelected because that is their focus, particularly in a redistricting year. You get that sense from your interaction with the legislators that there is that anxiety that I think is there to get out and campaign?
Yeah, I think there's definitely anxiety. That anxiety is always hanging over them, as you mentioned. But, you know, the leaders, Mike Shirkey, Jason Wentworth, they're not running for office again. And ultimately, they're going to be the people that have to work with Governor Whitmer and Senate Minority Leader Jim Ananick and Donna Lisinski to work out a deal here. The last 3 years, this negotiating the budget has played out into the fall. Will they be able to do something sooner than that? I would be surprised, but maybe they can. I'm surprised every day here. Can I throw a question at you? I have a question.
Sure.
I want to throw you.
Sure.
So how would you, longtime Democratic Party chair, how would you handle this Robert Regan special election? I'm really curious about this. This is a Republican leaning seat. It's very Republican. There's a lot of pushback on him. What would you do here? I keep thinking about this. How would you handle it, Mark? I'm curious.
Well, if you want to be a real sinister partisan, maybe it's in the Democrats' partisan interest that he get elected. And you have somebody like him sitting in the legislature. Because under our election laws, there's no way to take him off the ballot now.
Mm-hmm.
The only way he can get off the ballot is by moving, right? Out of the state, out of the district, et cetera. That's not going to happen. But as you point out, his district is going to change dramatically. He's running in the current gerrymandered seat. The district's going to change. It's going to be less gerrymandered. I have not delved into the statistics, but it's got to be, at least a little bit more competitive than the current one he runs in. So he's going to face a different electorate in the fall general election than he's about to face in this special. And so it could be, as you point out, that he's vulnerable there. But again, if he's the face of the Republican Party now, that may be good for Democrats. They can point to DiPerno if he gets nominated, a Caramo, a McCoskey, a Regan, saying, look, Michigan, this is the face of the Republican Party now. Who think the Ukraine invasion is fake, who think making jokes about rape is appropriate, who believe in the big lie, that's the choice in the fall. And I think as Jeff has pointed out on this show, that would be a gift to Democrats to have candidates like that on the general election ballot who are going to turn off independents and I think even a number of Republicans. A big issue that could be coming up as well, Greg, is abortion, right? What's the Supreme Court going to do with Roe v. Wade? If they overturn it or limit it substantially, that could inject a brand new and very volatile issue into the election. So, I know this is a long-winded answer to your question, but again, it depends on, I think, again, how devious-minded you are. It may be in the Democrats' partisan interest to have people like this in the legislature and on the ballot so that people see the true nature of the Republican Party and that the Democrats can campaign against these folks and say what a danger they are.
Is there just one follow up on this? Is there there's some chatter in GOP circles about running a write-in campaign to try to take votes away from Reagan. Is that, could that be successful? I mean, what are the odds of that? And then I'll drop this, but I am really curious of your thoughts on this.
Yeah. I mean, that, you know, that reinforces what I just said that, you know, that you can't take somebody off the ballot. It would be real. It's really difficult to run a write-in campaign. I mean, I've been part of some successful ones, but I've seen a lot of unsuccessful ones.
It just doesn't work very often, especially in a low turnout, low profile election.
Right. I mean, you've got to educate the voters about how to do it. It's a two-step process. You got to write the name in. Then you got to make sure you fill in the oval or the arrow, whatever the case may be. You know, and it's just really easy to just, you know, vote the party. And of course, in a general election situation, you've got the straight party option. Right. And people go in and they vote straight party. Mm-hmm. And with, you know, and so that's even another hurdle in a write-in situation. It would take a lot of money in a very short period of time. I mean, these elections are in early May now. Yep. Somebody would have to get right on this to organize a write-in and do a very expensive and intensive education effort in order to beat a Reagan, or at least divide enough of the votes up so that a Democrat comes through, because that may be the ultimate effect, that a Democrat in that seat wins.
No, that it's pretty interesting. Some major choices there for the Republican Party.
And these are things they've never had to deal with before, right? Gerrymandered seats. They, you know, their candidate, their moderate or their establishment candidate comes through, and then they get elected in the general election. This is a very different calculation for the Republican Party and the interest groups there. They may have to start spending a lot more money either blocking these extreme candidates in primaries or figuring out ways to beat them once they get in there. You know, of course, there's always the option. This has been kind of like the nuclear option of the legislature not seating somebody or expelling them. But as you know, from your investigative work, that's generally been reserved for people who have committed crimes. Mm-hmm. Right. And that's it elevates it to a whole nother level. If you say we're going to expel or not seat or deny committee assignments, you know, deny office budgets to people with these extreme views, that may actually make things worse for the Republicans were they to do that. But they have very few tools at their disposal to deal with these folks once they're on the verge of or actually in office.
Yeah, it's that, you know, this gets talked about a lot of not seating someone, but, it, you know, I have not seen that happen in my time here. There have been a lot of people that have had things, you know, criminal charges go on and they're still allowed to continue to serve. And the other thing, you know, from Reagan's perspective, all of these comments are now out there and it's for the voters to decide. So I don't know how the House leadership could turn around and say, well, voters, you decided this person is your representative and now we're going to second guess you. It's not like he made these comments after getting the general election win. So that would be extremely difficult. But I think, you know, he has been criticizing the House Speaker now on a regular basis by name. His Republican House Speaker, Jason Whitworth, Reagan is criticizing him personally. That does not usually go unresponded to.
Right. But it does show a breakdown of the discipline that we talked about earlier. Yeah. That, you know, the speaker controls the campaign money, the campaign apparatus of the House. But apparently Reagan believes he doesn't need it. He didn't need it to get through the primary. He doesn't need it to get elected. This is where the gerrymandering of the last 10 years has come back to haunt the Republicans. They created these districts and they created these monsters that are now emerging out of the, you know, the 2020 election, the Trump era, all this other kinds of stuff. It's really come back to haunt them. They probably won't admit it publicly, but I think they regret the gerrymandering, which has enabled, you know, folks like Reagan and McCoskey and others now to look like they're going to take seats in the state house.
It will be, it's I've already seen some of the redistricting commissioners, at least one of them, making the argument, hey, this is the redistricting process playing out. You know, we under the current districts, this is a heavily GOP seat. Democrats don't have a huge chance of winning this in the general election. And now going into the next cycle, this could be a battleground seat. So I've seen one of the commissioners making that argument. You know, I'm going to guess that the Republicans, some other people in the Republican Party, are going to be fighting Reagan in the August primary election, trying to prevent him to be their nominee there. This is not going to, this situation is not going to resolve itself for quite a while.
No, I mean, and once you're an incumbent, there are benefits that flow from that once you are actually in office and have all those things. So we've covered a wide variety of things here today, Craig, and we really, really, again, appreciate you pitching in. But I think we need to wrap it up for this week. And I'm sure we will talk again soon. So thanks again for being a pinch hitter for Jeff this week.
Hey, thank you, Mark, so much for having me.
That's our time for this week. My great thanks to Craig Bauger for his insights on all of the give and take and events in Lansing. You can be part of the conversation if you'd like. Send us an email, comments@arepublicpodcast.com. And if the Republic is still standing, we'll be back in a week. I'm Mark Brewer. Thanks very much.
You can subscribe to A Republic If You Can Keep It on all major podcast sites. A Republic If You Can Keep It is a production of Michigan Citizens for a Better Tomorrow.